turn this on. It's not just a matter of what you undergo physically, but it's a matter of how you're identifying culturally, socially.
John, isn't there a parallel Christianity's Western Christianity's? I mean, it isn't. I know, but you know, oftentimes it's perceived that way.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. If we think about that, yeah, thanks. Because this seems remote, but the reality is, irrespective of where we find the church, where we find ourselves, there is a tendency to make particular cultural markers of identity normative for Christians. I think this is what you're talking about, right? Yeah, exactly. I would illustrate this out of, I can talk about people in other places I've lived because you don't know them. And so it's not slander. But probably one of the most disappointing days that I had when we were in Cincinnati and I was teaching an adult class. It was just an ongoing thing. It was a group of people, you know, who met every week. People came and went, but kind of a class with an identity, and we just studied, and I was one of the regular teachers. And one Sunday, somehow, we got into a discussion of how everybody ought to know the right kind of business casual clothing that ought to be worn to church. Okay. This may have been during football season, when there were people who were concerned about folks wearing Bengals jerseys to church, but we got really concerned because there were people who wore Steelers jerseys to church, and that's just like awful. So I left, and I'm sure Tammy would say, yeah, you just were glum the whole day about that, because it was, you know, such an act of cultural insensitivity, if nothing else. Okay, well, years later, I can't remember how many years, but it was like the opposite, where spontaneously in the class, there's a discussion of how can we be more welcoming to more kinds of people, and what are we doing that maybe makes people who aren't as comfortably middle class as many of us are, you know, what are we doing that might make them feel less than welcome? Okay, and that illustrates kind of, I think this larger thing, you know, that we're talking about. So there's always this question of what's gospel, and what's cultural, and how do we test that? Well, we test it with gospel, right? And that's really what Paul is doing here, and it's. In some way, I appreciate you bringing this up, because in some ways, it sort of shows how it ought to be easier for us to handle this question, because at least circumcision was biblical, you know? I mean, it's right there. And it just seems a natural conclusion. Well, if we've been doing this for about 1,500 years, it seems like we ought to continue. If this has been the marker of identity of God's people, it should just continue to be the marker of identity of God's people. But Paul is saying, look deeply into the story in Romans chapter 4, and you see that there's something even more foundational, and that is faith. So chapter 5 is saying, this is what is then transformative to the whole world. This is what gives us peace with God, even under difficult circumstances. And this is how God is rolling back the power of sin and death that begins with Adam. If the story of Adam is death for humanity, then the story of the second Adam is life for humanity. So it's very important at that point to realize something that I think was more natural for them and is more difficult for us because of a lot of church history. And that is that the gospel is not about forgiveness with transformation kind of as a maybe. The gospel is about forgiveness and transformation. That what God is doing is not just removing our guilt, but he is removing the power of sin from our lives, because sin is death. Whether we are forgiven or not, living in sin, experiencing sin, is living in and experiencing death. And who wants to be dead? No one. Okay. The only people who want to be dead are people for whom life has become living death for whatever reason. And what we look forward to is not death, but but to life. So, you know, transformation is at the core of this. So when you're reading in chapter 5, to summarize, this is really from 1 Corinthians and not from Romans, but it captures the idea of the second half of Romans 5. In Adam all die, in Christ all are made alive. Okay, well, what does made alive look like? Chapter 6, oh, so we should just keep sinning so there can be more grace, Paul says. That's nonsense. Okay, if you have died to sin, you have been raised to life. And so you live the life, not the death life. And if you had been enslaved to sin and death, bad master. Okay, now you have been put under a good master. Chapter 7, if you were married to sin and death, well, that marriage is over because you died. So now you have a new loyalty. In practical terms, we come to the end of chapter 7, and Paul says, well, here's the problem. The thing that I don't want to do is the thing that I do, and the thing that I do is the thing that I don't want to do, or what, I don't know, all of those things. The do's and the don'ts are all backwards. And he asks this rhetorical question, wretched person that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? And the answer is God. And so chapter 8 is about what that answer looks like, and the answer is the Spirit. It's the Spirit who empowers us to be transformed to the image of Christ, to live differently, to live in intimate relationship with God, so that even the things that we don't know how to pray about are communicated to God, and to live as a part of what God is doing in the whole world. He says the whole creation is groaning until the sons of God, and sons used deliberately because in that culture they're the ones who inherit, are revealed. So, you know, the struggle, the angst, the pain, the misery that we feel is a part of what's going on in creation as a whole, but it's pointing us to the end. The end meaning not the end of the world like its destruction, but the goal, what God is bringing about. So Romans 8:28, that passage that we typically translate as all things work together for good for those who are loved by God and called according to his purpose. We maybe need to modify the way that we translate that within the bounds of the grammar of the original statement to understand it's not simply for, but it's through. It is through the transformed people of God that God is working out his purpose. So this is more than just everything's going to be okay for me. It's I am a part of the grand plan of God by which he is taking his world back. Okay. And so this is the unstoppable, unbeatable plan of God. Chapters 9 to 11 has been a consideration of the question, is God playing fair with us with this? Because it seems to me he made a promise to Israel, and now you're saying a lot of Israelites are being excluded from this because they don't have faith in God, and that sound, or faith in Jesus. And that sounds like God is backing out of his promises. And Paul is doing two things there. One is he's saying he's God, he can fulfill his promises any way he wants to. But the other is to say it has never been about, you know, who's your daddy, if I may use that expression. It was never about descent from Abraham because there was always a remnant within Israel defined by faith who are the true people of God. And Paul says in chapter 11, even now, the gospel is open for all. So now we come to chapter 12, and I did do the whole recap right there, okay. But I guess for a reason that I just followed impulsively, and that is to understand, we're kind of finally getting to the point of the letter. And hasn't it made a lot of points already? Yes, but the point of the letter is, church, get yourself together. And so chapters 12 to 15 are really about that, about church, get yourself together, and how we're thinking now about the universal need for forgiveness and transformation that we all have, and what that implies about the nature of the transformation and how we live with one another. Okay, so let's kind of be alert to that. And we're going to run into some really famous statements along the way here. So Romans, I had not on the right page, Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. You probably know these, but I'm going to mess with you, okay? All right. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your minds, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Okay, let me just throw this out to you. In light of what we're thinking about here, what do you notice about those two verses and what Paul says? What kind of jumps out at you as significant there? And there are no wrong answers here because it seems significant to you, and that's what I'm asking. So. Therefore, okay, yeah, he's drawing a conclusion, yeah. So everything that's been said before is now coming to a kind of a point, and this is the implication. What else jumps out at you? Yeah, present your body as a living sacrifice. Draws on language from the temple. Okay, you would not want to crawl up on the altar in the temple, okay? But the image of the sacrifice which is offered, you know, why do you offer sacrifice in the temple? Well, you do it for forgiveness, but you also do it for thanksgiving. And so this is the idea of thanking God, honoring God, extolling God with a sacrifice that he describes as a living sacrifice, yeah. So we see again a kind of a fulfillment of something that's been a part of our experience for a long time. What else jumps out at you?
Couldn't they make a? It's interesting that he says your body is a living sacrifice, a physical body.
Mm-hmm.
We've just been talking about circumcision.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, you're not honoring God by being circumcised if you're a Gentile. All of us are honoring God by giving our lives to God in this process of transformation. Yeah. Let's explore this. Don't be conformed to this world. How is the division that they've been experiencing a kind of conformity to this world? How would you describe that? You know, Jewish Christians, Gentile Christians, at odds with each other. How is that conformity to the world? Okay, yeah, we've got this very specific thing that several years before under Claudius, Claudius just said, you people, I can't deal with you, out of Rome, because of pretty violent disputes that were going on within the Jewish community. Zoom way back into human history and human experience. What do you see along these lines? How have people been getting along generally? Poorly? Okay, yeah, very poor. Where does that start in the Bible, by the way? Where does people start getting along poorly? Cain kills Abel. This is a definite marker for me. You know, wouldn't it be great if we were all just one great family together? Well, when we were, one brother killed the other. How's it going? Right? I think a lot about the way the second psalm begins. Why do the nations rage and the peoples imagine a vain thing? Which is described in the next verse as rebellion against God, but just that constant state of the world in turmoil. Don't have to go very far into the news at any point to see this being reflected, right? Okay, so conformity to the world means tribalism. Transformation means embracing people who aren't like us at that point. And why is that God's kind of transformation? Because God tells us we all have the same problem, we all need the same solution, and none of us deserve it, but he gives it freely. So it's on that basis that we receive it. John, you look thoughtful.
How is not being worldly a way to test God's will?
it's not so much, I think, that God's will is always the opposite of worldly. It's that worldly, it's that the opposite of God's will is, maybe I'm not doing this very logically. If the world has been under the control of sin and death, and if Christ is introducing something new and fundamentally different, which comes from God, then there's a conflict between these two influences that we always need to be aware of. So it would be false, for example, to say anything that people at large do is worldly and therefore wrong. Okay, just to pull something out, buttons are wrong. Okay, and I chose that, as you know, because the Amish don't use buttons, at least many of them. Okay, because buttons, I don't know, did you know that buttons cause pride? I thought I was just an arrogant, bad person, but it turns out it's my buttons. Okay. I think about it. I don't know either. Yeah. Apparently, in history, they could be real fancy schmancy or something. I don't know. Yeah, exactly. But there's that idea. But if we understand, okay, the world is under sin and death, so the world does things in a particular way that are deathy. And a part of that is the conflict that is grounded in human rebellion against God and expresses itself in this kind of tribalism, factionalism, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas what God is doing is gracious, is leveling in all these ways.
Maybe it's making it better. It's obvious that it's better.
Yeah, so, yeah.
On one hand, you have worldly, on the other hand, God's will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's life stuff versus death stuff. It's love stuff versus hate stuff. I mean, it's that essential and that basic. It's gracious as opposed to selfish. Doug?
So it's not here talking about God's will for my life. It's about
no.
God, like,
from the big picture, yeah. The will of God for your life is that you be loving, gracious, accepting, forgiving, generous. Well, he's going to talk about the specifics here. No, you can do that in almost any career except Pittsburgh Steelers defense. Okay. That would be bad. And New York Yankees. Okay, you can't work for the Yankees and be a godly person. Anyway.
This is going to sound like a non sequitur. Is it the Bible Project that we're using with the read-along?
It is.
This morning's little tape.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And defines the day of the Lord, but it talks about Babylon. What is Babylon?
Yes. Yes.
And you can get it on YouTube. You don't have to be in the project.
Yes.
If you just Google YouTube.
YouTube Bible Project, Day of the Lord. Yes. I totally recommend this video. Yeah. And very important. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about this. Okay, first of all, my enthusiasm for the Bible Project is almost boundless. Okay. So far, with all the videos that we've used with the Bible Read Along Project, I've found two quibbles. Okay, I can't remember what one of them was. The other one is the Gospels do not say Jesus was crucified on a hill. I know, on a hill far away, but it's not in the Bible. Okay. Anyway, but it's at that granular level that I find anything wrong. The big Bible Project picture is one story that leads to Jesus. And in this, in particular, because we've been reading the literature of the Old Testament in the Bible Read-Through Program that comes after the Babylonian exile. And so a lot of the prophets have been talking about what happens to Babylon and so forth. If you're reading, we just read Daniel fairly recently, and you see the transition from the Babylonians to the Persians with the story of Belshazzar's feast and the writing on the wall and so forth. And we're thinking, yay, the Babylonians are out. And the Persians turn out to be just as bad in most respects. So, what is Babylon as a kind of a concept in the Bible? Well, no accident. You go back to Genesis chapter 11, and it's the Tower of Babel. Yeah, and that is, again, that is supposed to evoke what you know, this thing that Babylon does. It is the, you know, it is human pride and the seeking of human power that binds people together into empire that oppresses. Okay, and this is what Babylon is later. So Babylon becomes a kind of a universal symbol in prophetic discourse for all human empire building. Okay, and human empire building, which is about being powerful, being wealthy, making other people do what you want.
And he ties it to the power struggle.
Yes.
For the power to define what is good and evil.
Yes.
So he goes back to Genesis 1.
Yes.
And the,
yes.
The
serpent. Yeah. Yeah. Very. Thank you. This is great. Yeah. What's the question in the garden? Are you going to submit to God, or are you going to try to be God on your own? Yeah, determining what is right and wrong. And yeah, and so what the world, what Babylon describes as good is have more for myself, have power over other people. Okay. Years ago, I was reading a guy who's a retired American diplomat named Lawrence Harrison, and he had worked in the Caribbean his whole life, and he said, This was when Haiti was very much in the news. Haiti needs to be in the news now. But he said part of the reason that problems in Haiti seem to be just about intractable is that there's such a deep ideology through voodoo culture in Haiti that says if you have the opportunity to steal from someone, you should, because that means your spirits are stronger than their spirits. So there's a fundamental kind of social construct that's at work that just undermines any kind of orderly society. Now, there are a lot of other things going on, too. The fact that they had to pay reparations to France for centuries and so forth didn't help, and some things of that nature. But that kind of illustrates this idea. So to come to zoom back into this, the kind of tribalism that has infected the Roman Church is a species of why do the nations rage in Psalm 2, which is illustrated in the story of Babel. The empire falls apart because the people can't understand each other, and they become mutually hostile towards one another. The whole legal profession, John, is built on the need for settling this kind of thing, right, between sinful people. Yeah, 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 and that doesn't mean lawyers are bad. They're bad for other reasons, but it means, yeah, as long as there's sin in the world, we need law and lawyers and structures and some modicum of justice that we can bring, right? And I'm glad your trial is over, as I'm sure you are too. So there's another one down the road, I'm sure, at some point. So this is the very problem. So to be not conformed to the world, but to be transformed, is to adopt a set of values and put them into practice that look more like the cross than like the Tower of Babel, you know, if you will, in that way. All right, so let's go on. Let's look at some more of this, because I've got to finish this book. Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention. I'm sorry. I've got the ESV here. It says that you may discern what is the will of God. I'm not sure that discern is the best translation there. The same word is used in verse 28 of chapter 1, which says, since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. The word here that is translated discern by the ESV in verse 2 of chapter 12 is translated as acknowledge back earlier. And I really think that this later text is alluding to that earlier one. He's saying, as a sinner, you did not acknowledge the goodness of God. Now you are acknowledging that in the way that you are being transformed and you are pursuing it. Okay. So the aim of all of this is that you'd be the opposite of what you were as a rebel. And I think that helps us understand. And this kind of goes along with Doug's point, too. The issue here is not figuring stuff out. There's not much that has to be figured out here. Okay? It is, the issue is not, what does God want me to do? He's shown me what he wants me to do. He's shown me what the transformed life looks like. It's the pursuit of that. So sometimes when we find ourselves, I just don't know what to do. Well, there can be weighty things involved in that. But often it's like, oh, you know, you could do any one of several things. Just be a kind, loving, forgiving, generous person. So let's look at the next section, verses 3 to 8. By the grace given me, I say to everyone among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. Ha! How does that fit into what's been going on? Yeah. Me and my people, we know what's going on, and you and your people need to get with it. Yeah, that's been the issue. So don't be that. But to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. For as in one body we have many members, and the members do not all have the same function, so we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually members of one another. Okay, individually members of one another, part of a larger body. The term member here, you know, we can confuse that because we talk about being a member of a church, but it means body parts. So each part is part of the whole, and that's true even with the people who are not like you, because of different background, different culture, different ethnic identity. And then, having gifts that differ according to the grace given us, let us use them, if prophecy in proportion to our faith, if service in serving, the one who teaches in his teaching, and the one who exhorts in exhortation, the one who contributes in generosity, the one who leads with zeal, the one who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness. So here he's talking about, you know, this thing that I think American Christians have talked about a lot in our experience, and that is that, you know, we have different gifts, different abilities, naturally and empowered by the Spirit. But it's important to see that in this larger context where there has been this kind of fundamental rift in the church as well along these ethnic lines. Irrespective of what your difference is, we respect and affirm one another in love of Christ. Let me say a couple of things about the concept of spiritual gifts in the New Testament. A lot of us have probably taken spiritual gifts tests or inventories in the past. Okay. There are few things that have been done in the name of Jesus in America that are more misleading than this, although there's a pretty high competition for this kind of thing. Scott, as a social scientist, what do you think of the validity of these tests? That's enough answer right there, right? Well put. I knew you'd be right on that. Okay. That's great. I really appreciate that. Yeah, exactly. It's also important to realize Paul does not give us a complete listing of every possible spiritual gift. Okay. There's a list here. There's one in 1 Corinthians. There's one in Ephesians. A lot of these tests, they aggregate those, and then they run it past the church staff, and they say, are there any volunteer positions that you need that we haven't discussed here? So we drop in musical ability. You know, and things like that, because we definitely need worship leaders and, you know, working with children. So those typically fall in, even though there is no gift of working with children in the New Testament. Okay. When Paul gives a list, it's never exhaustive. It's always evocative. Okay. It's always there to give us the idea of the kind of thing that we're talking about. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that since the first century until now, there have been 5 billion Christians. I don't know if that's a realistic number or not. How many different configurations of spiritual gifts do you suppose existed among those 5 billion people? I would say 5 billion. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that this is in general kind of an affirmation of our uniqueness and how our uniqueness is not a liability but is an asset if we understand it and if we appreciate one another. In that way. So, all right, let's go on. This next section is sometimes, in olden days, this was often referred to as telegraphic exhortations. Now, that's a real anachronism for you right there, okay, because they didn't have telegraph, and now neither do we. But in telegraphy, there was a premium on using as few words as possible because you had to pay by the word or by the letter or something like that. So lots of short instructions. Let me just read this, and let's see if we can kind of generalize what's going on. Let love be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good, love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor, do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord, rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, and seek to show hospitality. Can you kind of put a bow around that? What is most of that, much of that about? Okay, okay. And what's kind of the focus of that, how we are to live? Yeah, it really is. Yeah, and practical expression of that in a lot of different ways. Now, how would that address a church that has had this fission? Fission. I could get my fission and fusion backwards sometimes. How would that instruction address this church with its division between Jew and Gentile? Yeah, love one another despite our differences. Love our differences, in that way. And expressed in practical terms, you know, show hospitality. You ought to sit down at table with one another, which is going to come up in chapter 14. I think the word zeal is really interesting here because Paul's zeal before he became a Christian was expressed violently in, you know, going after people who were violating the standards of Judaism. As I've quoted N.T. Wright many times, in Paul's day, zeal was something you did with a knife. Now, zeal is something that you do by inviting people to eat with you. Okay, as an example, he has flipped that over with this expression. Let's get some more of this. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, live in harmony with one another, do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly, never be wise in your own sight, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing, by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Ah, okay, that last phrase there kind of captures it, doesn't it? Overcome evil with good. So it's about unity. It's about forgiveness. It's about humility. Okay. Let's remind ourselves maybe at this point that humility as a biblical virtue is not, we often think of humility as being modest about our accomplishments. That's kind of adjacent to humility in the Bible. Humility in the Bible is about taking the position of a servant and serving other people. As I do that, then I am acting in the love of Christ. These two things are just really inextricable in that way. And much of what he talks about here is doing that. And you notice the strong element of grace that's involved. Bless those who persecute you. Don't seek vengeance, etc. This is living by radical forgiveness. All right, let's talk a little bit about chapter 13. The first seven verses of chapter 13 are, in a lot of our experience, cited as a kind of an exhaustive biblical theology of civil government. And I would say it is a portion of a biblical theology of civil government. Okay, this is not everything that we would want to say about civil government. Let's, before we talk about that, let's think about the situation here. Paul is talking about the Roman government. Anybody know who the emperor was when he was writing this book? Nero, yeah. Not a great guy. Okay. How did Nero become emperor? Well, his mother was the last wife of Claudius, the previous emperor, who on balance was a pretty good emperor to everyone's surprise. Sometime you should read Robert Graves' I, Claudius. It's a brilliant novel and pretty faithful historically, though, very imaginative. Claudius was a pretty decent ruler, but he was terrible with women. So just one bad wife after another after another. And the last one is the mother of Nero, and she persuades him to rewrite his will so that Nero becomes his sole heir, and then she poisons him. I mean, Claudius, not Nero. So Nero becomes emperor at the age of 17. How we doing, Joe? Among other things, he enters the Olympics in all the events, and he wins all of them, okay, including the singing competition. He won the chariot race. He fell out of his chariot, but everybody else stopped while he got back on his chariot. I don't know. He won the club championship. What can I say? Okay, that's all I'll say about that. Really kind of a megalomaniac. Well, for much of his rule, he wasn't that interested in ruling. Okay, he had a couple of assistants, one of whom has a famous name, Seneca. He had a huge apple juice company. No, that's actually named for a city in New York. It was named for Seneca. The other was named Burrus, and he just left the governing to them, but eventually he got tired of what was going on with them, and he sent them into exile and then ordered them to commit suicide eventually. And Seneca was particularly interesting with this. He had a big party for his suicide, and everyone's eating and drinking. And then he got up and opened his veins and began to read a speech. But then he realized he wasn't going to make it to the end of his speech. I know. He realized he wasn't going to make it to the end of his speech, so he asked to be bandaged up so he could finish his speech. But he didn't make it. He died. And that was, anyway, brutal times. Okay, see The Godfather Part 2. So this is Nero. Famously, there is a gigantic fire in Rome. This comes later than Romans under Nero. And the poor section of the city just burns to the ground. And the expression "Nero fiddled while Rome burns" came out of the public assumption that Nero didn't do enough to stop the fire, there were rumors that he had started the fire. Well, it was because of that he began openly persecuting Christians in the AD 60s. He pinned it on the Christians, and according to Tacitus, he did all kinds of atrocities to Christians. He had them tied up and rolled in pitch and then hung up and set alight to illuminate garden parties and things of this nature. So very, very brutal stuff. All of that is later than this, but it helps us contextualize what is going on. Okay. Now, that's Nero. What do you see? Just take a look at these verses. What do you see Paul saying positively about government? It is established by God for what purpose? Sorry?
Living in peace with each other.
Yeah, living in peace with each other and establishing, I'm going to add some words to what the text says, establishing justice, but we'd have to understand this. It's establishing an approximation of justice. Okay. Would you say an approximation of justice is what the legal system works out?
Would I say that's in fact what it is?
Yeah. Yeah, we do the best we can, right? We do the best we can with what we've got,
which is
exactly, yeah. So this is the perspective. Now, in the history of the church, there has been this edict that came down, a decade or so before, that says Jews out of Rome. Okay, was that a just or unjust edict? I'd say it's unjust. We're not dealing with the wrongdoers. We're just saying, class of people, get out. Okay. So there's been some injustice that has been experienced there. What's your attitude going to be if you and your people were the object of that? Very negative. Okay, very negative. Let's add to this that in this period there is a strong impulse in among the Jewish people towards nationalism and militaristic nationalism. Let's say Paul is writing Romans about 56 or so, which is a decent guess. By 68, 12 years, and 12 years is nothing, okay? By 66, make it 10 years, there is open rebellion in Palestine against Roman rule from 66 to 70, which ends in the destruction of Jerusalem. And so that thing that's going on among Jewish people in Palestine is being felt in other places as well, where the idea is faithfulness to God means overthrowing the Roman Empire. Well, what is Paul saying about that at this point? Forget it, okay? Let it work for what it's supposed to do. Now, does that mean that subjection to government is boundless and unconditional? No, it doesn't, okay? It is under the aegis of what we've been talking about before, which is, you know, our primary mandate is to love one another. But, very interesting, don't let the heading here throw you off. Look at verse 7. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. Okay. Then, owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. All right. So, pay what you owe. There's a boundary there. Okay. Give the honor to the government that is the government's due, which is respect and affirm its justice-keeping function. But then, what do I primarily do? To everyone, I owe love. Okay, so there's a way here in which we need to temper some of maybe the most enthusiastic applications of this text sometimes in our own setting. Friday night, we had a couple people over, we got to talking, and one of the things that we got onto in our conversation, I'll wrap this up as quickly as I can. There are two kinds of people in the world, those who divide everything into two categories and those who don't. And I tend to do this sometimes, okay, divide things into two categories. I think, broadly speaking, we can discern kind of two ways that people think about the way that Christianity ought to work in the world. One of them emphasizes establishing social order. The other one emphasizes transformation of the individual in a way that in turn transforms the larger society in which people live. Okay. If we put the emphasis on the former, a lot of what we do is about establishing lines of authority and responsibilities of obedience. Okay. And I'm not against authority and obedience. But if we put the emphasis on the latter, then the primary thing that we're thinking about is building and becoming by the Spirit of God the kind of people who live according to the gospel out of the abundance of our hearts. I think it's very important that we distinguish those two things, and especially in light of what Paul is saying here. Does government have a function? Yes, that it does. It is to establish a modicum of order against the forces of chaos that humans gravitate to under the power of sin and death. But the primary thing the gospel does is not give us a better way to do government. The primary thing the gospel does is give us a means to be the kinds of people who can live in love and harmony with one another despite our differences.
And if we do that, then the order will take care of itself.
It does. It does, absolutely. And you see this reflected in all kinds of political philosophy, you know, that you can't run a democracy without virtuous people, you know, and things of that nature. But I think especially right now, when there's lots of talk about Christian nationalism and Christianizing government and so forth. We need to think carefully about the limits of the power of government as compared to the nature of the power of God in Christ and the power of the Spirit, and think about how that works out. So, quick thoughts, questions, observations, rude remarks on that. That's right, meaning not we all go to heaven someday, but it operates on a fundamentally different principle. Jesus is king right now, but not like Caesar is king. Yeah, yeah, that's very, very important. Doug, you get 100 for the day. Yeah. Well, even under the authority of Rome, my primary responsibility is not to just do all the things that a Roman might say amount to good citizenship. I'm going to be exceptionally generous, loving, forgiving, etc., in ways that will go well beyond what they would say. Well, you know, I've paid my taxes. I've kept the law. I'm a good person. Sorry? Yeah, yes, okay. Yeah, one of the fun things, well, he doesn't say this about Christians, but it would come later. Tacitus is a Roman historian who says, we just don't understand Jewish people. Okay, they keep to themselves, which is weird. But they don't think that children are the property of the father. So, you know, whereas if we don't want a child, we just leave it out to die. They keep all their children. In fact, sometimes they go out and find the children that we left to die, and they bring them into their homes and raise them as their own. Okay. And that's where he says, this just doesn't make any sense. Everybody knows your children are your property. No, everybody doesn't know that. All right. Go in peace. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.